Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Listen to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Standing down again. Another firefighter safety stand down. For what? We did that last year. How about you just shut up, buckle up, slow down, and stop? We, and that's all of us, haven't done all that great since last year's stand down. We probably got a C minus, and while we didn't totally fail, there is a lot more for improvement, or a lot of room for improvement, as far as seriously impacting firefighter injury and death. So building on the success of last year's National Firefighter Stand Down, the IAFC and the IAFF have mutually called for another needed stand down to be held starting Wednesday, June 21st. So really, is this just as simple as shutting up, buckling up, and slowing down and stopping? Well, we'll find out in a couple of minutes as the IAFF's Rich Duffy, the IAFC's President Bill Killen, and the IFC Executive Director, Gary Breeze, join us for a rapid-fire discussion on what's being done and what we can all do to keep lowering the firefighter injury and death numbers in relation to going and coming from fire calls. By the way, for those of you that are planning to, or if you haven't and want to plan to, join us in Baltimore, July 25th through the 30th, for Firehouse Expo. If you've never been, you want to go. This is the largest fire and emergency service event on the East Coast. It's 5 days loaded with education and training, all sorts of exhibits, 3 days actually, the exhibits are open, lots of hands-on opportunities, leadership programs, there'll be over 150 instructors, 80 classroom sessions, and over 430 exhibitors, so it should be really good. And if you've never been to Baltimore for this event, it's a great town, we have a good time. Also, we're going to be doing a Through the Smoke live show. That's right. You too can participate in Through the Smoke, and watch this website, firehouse.com, for additional details as we move forward in planning some live shows in Baltimore in a couple of weeks so you can participate in Through the Smoke. We anticipate having firefighters in attendance where we have certain folks joining us, and we'll have some questions and answers, some audience participation. It should be fun. So keep that in mind as we get ready to join each other in Baltimore in just a couple of weeks. Again, mark your calendar. It's July 25th through the 30th. Before we go on to our discussion about the stand down, I got a couple things I want to share with you. First of all, if you've seen the news, but there's been a civil suit filed against a fire apparatus maker. And this is down in Amarillo, Texas. The parents of an Amarillo firefighter killed when he fell out of the apparatus while he was en route to a call last year have filed a lawsuit against the vehicle's makers. Firefighter Christopher Brian Hunton suffered fatal injuries when he fell through the rear passenger door of an American LaFrance ladder truck. The truck was rounding a turn. A suit filed earlier this week alleges negligence by the truck's makers and service providers and challenges the legality of the state's caps on punitive damages and product liability cases, according to a report in the Amarillo Globe News. The left rear passenger door had a tendency to open while the fire truck was being operated, according to a state fire marshal report. Firefighter Hunton was not wearing his seatbelt at the time of the accident. The suit claims that American LaFrance, Freightliner, Patriarch Partners, Dalmatian Corporation, Daimler Chrysler, and a bunch of others, I guess, designed the vehicle with a defective and dangerous door latch and failed to give appropriate warnings of the danger. A local dealership, Amarillo Truck Center, was also named in the suit, which claims the business was negligent in performing service, maintenance, and repairs to the left rear passenger door latch. Reps of American LaFrance at the truck center told the newspaper Tuesday they have not yet seen the suit and couldn't comment. The suit also challenges other caps on punitive damages and product liability issues. Firefighter Hunton, age 27, tragically died 2 days later after he fell from the apparatus as firefighters responded to a call on April 23rd, 05. Firefighter Hunton sat in the back left passenger seat, which faces the truck's rear, is directly behind the driver. The door apparently flew open as the truck went through a slight dip while making its turn. And while we don't question the importance of a door to be secure and shut and make sure that the door is made right so it properly secures and shuts, doors do open up. However, if the firefighter had been wearing a seatbelt, maybe we wouldn't be having this discussion. Maybe there wouldn't be lawsuits. And you know, forget the discussion, forget the lawsuits, forget all that. Maybe he'd still be with us and all the pain that goes along with losing a young firefighter, really a firefighter of any age. And you know, the seatbelt issue is a tough one, and we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes, and we're going to have input from Rich Duffy and from Gary Breeze and Bill Killen. Fact of the matter is, if you wear your seatbelt, odds are you're not going to fall out. So no disrespect to the tragic loss that happened in Amarillo, and no disrespect to anybody else involved. And if any manufacturers have doors that open automatically, they need to fix the problem. But you know what? If you know the door opens up and it's been a problem, take the truck out of service and enforce seatbelt policies. Is it tough to wear seatbelts sometimes? Absolutely. Is it difficult and challenging, especially when we're trying to gear up and get all our equipment on and everything else? Absolutely. But if you don't arrive on the scene, if you get ejected or something like that happens to you, none of that stuff matters anyway. So the answer needs to be everybody wears a seatbelt while responding. Quit the lame excuses. Quit the whinies. Put your damn seatbelt on, and we don't have this problem to talk about. So again, in our deepest honor and respect to the families involved and the firefighters involved, we're not talking about that specifically, but the fact of the matter is it can't ignore the point that maybe if he had his belt on, we wouldn't have this discussion. Maybe you've also been looking at the news where they've been talking about New York and Washington and others not getting the amount of money they wanted for federal security funding. The chairman of the 9/11 Commission said this week that it defies logic that a secret panel of bureaucrats could slash New York City's federal security funding. You know, there are two cities that Osama bin Laden has said before 9/11 and after 9/11 he wants to hit, and that's Washington and New York. So we're not sure what the hell's going on and who's in charge of all these secret committees and all that, but look, it doesn't take a whole lot of sense to figure out that they're going to hit New York, Washington. Sure, they may hit some little town in the middle of nowhere as well just to keep people on their toes, but why wouldn't they go for the biggest, most valued target? So if anyone's listening who has any pull in Washington, and there may be a few out there, consider a little common sense once in a while. It might be nice to see that inside the Beltway. You know, some of you may have read, and hopefully you're aware of the situation that occurred a couple months ago in Providence, Rhode Island. Several Providence firefighters suffered cyanide poisoning while fighting some building fires. And the fire chief of Providence, Chief Dave Costa, tasked numerous fire officers and union reps to find out what happened. Why were their firefighters being poisoned by cyanide? And it really was quite a big deal. There was a lot of questions. And really what happened to these firefighters on March 23rd and 24th is amazing. What seemed to be three routine business and house fires ended up sending 28 firefighters from Providence to hospitals with headaches, dizziness, and incoherence. 27 of them were tested for cyanide poisoning over that two-day span, and eight of them had elevated levels of cyanide in their blood. And two were serious enough to need an antidote. You know, I have a friend of mine who's the deputy assistant chief of the Providence Fire Department, Kurt Verone, and Kurt and I have taught together, so that's how we've gotten to know each other. And Kurt called me that day when this was going on, and we kind of put our heads together. Cyanide poisoning. How could firefighters get cyanide poisoning? Duh, it's in the smoke. It's in the stuff that we're breathing. And really, after that, I started thinking maybe when we pull up on the scene of a fire, instead of saying smoke's showing, because, look, right or wrong, all of us from one time or another have gone, it's just a little smoke, why wear a mask? Why worry about this? But, you know, that stuff builds up over time. And so maybe instead of saying smoke's showing, maybe we say on the scene, establishing Maple Avenue Command, I've got cyanide showing. And maybe that'll make us start thinking a little bit differently. Well, there's a report out now, and if you look right on your computer screen, you can click the PDF and get a copy of that report. But better than that, I've got on the phone with us for a quick discussion to fill us in on what happened in Providence is Deputy Assistant Chief Kurt Verone. Kurt, we welcome you to Through the Smoke on Firehouse.com.
Thanks, Billy.
Kurt, what happened? What's the deal? What happened?
Well, it was the type of thing that started evolving over the course of three fires, over the course of about 20 hours in a fairly typical day in the Providence Fire Department. Probably the only thing that wasn't typical is that we were really fortunate. I think the fire service was really fortunate that there was a really sharp doctor working at Rhode Island Hospital on the day that the first fire happened.
Now, is that a trauma center?
Yeah, it's a trauma center. It's affiliated with Brown University Medical School.
Okay.
And the doctor that ordered the cyanide test on one of our firefighters in the first place is a professor. And Rhode Island Hospital is one of only eight laboratories in the country that can actually do cyanide testing. And that's to the best of our knowledge. There may be a few others out there, but we researched it as best we could.
Okay.
But cyanide test is not something that every hospital does. Every hospital can draw the blood, but typically what they'll do is send the cyanide test out to
Curry, am I correct that it's not typically a run test for smoke inhalation?
Oh, exactly. I think the assumption on most doctors' parts is when they have a victim, whether it's a civilian or a firefighter, come in with smoke inhalation, their first move is to check for carbon monoxide, and they'll also check for lactic acid. And if they got high carbon monoxide, the assumption is no problem, it's carbon monoxide, and that's the end of the inquiry. And they don't usually go through the cyanide test for a couple of reasons. One is that it's going to take anywhere from 2 to 5 hours for the test to come back if you do the test in-house. If not, it could take anywhere from a day to a week for the test to come back.
How easy is this test administered? Can any hospital, they all can do it? Or
No. It's. I mean, I'm sure they could if they chose to, but it's a fairly complicated test.
Okay.
You need somebody with not just typical lab skills, but toxicology skills to do the test. But the point is, to an ER doc who's got a critically ill firefighter, a critically ill smoke inhalation victim, what good is a test that's going to take a week to come back? You've got to treat that patient now. And as a result, most doctors have not been ordering the test. Therefore, we don't have a good picture on what's been going on with firefighters and smoke inhalation. It's a test that is not routinely done.
Well, now, Curt, when I first got that phone call from you that morning and we were chatting and we got a retired chief, John Eversole from Chicago Hazmat, on the phone, and Tom Hales at NIOSH, were putting our heads together. And through this whole process, I'm thinking, well, cyanide poisoning, smoke poisoning, whatever, why weren't they wearing their masks? Why weren't they protected? Mm-hmm. But you explained to me several firefighters outside the fire also experienced it, such as your pump operator.
Oh yeah,
correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean the first fire out of the three that we that triggered this investigation was primarily an outside fire where it was a fire in a fast food restaurant that had a mansard style facade on the front of it, kind of like you'd see in a McDonald's kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And most of the firefighting was done outside. The fire was in the facade. The guys inside the building said the smoke was better. The atmosphere was better inside the building than it was outside. So the guys on the outside that were pulling the soffits and opening up with saws and stuff, they took the biggest beating. But they were they had their masks on. They'd take their masks off. The smoke all of a sudden would swirl, would get a gust of wind, and it would blow the smoke in their faces. By the time they put their face masks on, the wind had shifted again, and the smoke had lifted. So it was one of those situations. But, you know, I think, Billy, you talked about why didn't they have their mask on. I think that the fire service is in a sort of a cultural dilemma, and we have our firefighters sort of culturally conditioned for a lot of reasons, including staffing issues, response time of mutual aid companies, everything. Everybody's pretty much conditioned to go on air as late as possible so that you save that air, that valuable air, until you actually need it. And then if the atmosphere is tenable once you're out of air, you hang in there. And that's a cultural condition. And I'm not sure, I mean, we can pound the desk, we can lecture, we can put up signs.
Sure.
I think the best way to solve this problem is through instrumentation. There's instrumentation out there that can detect cyanide, that can detect all of the fire gases. And it's inconceivable to me that a firefighter would have an instrument in his hand that said, this toxic levels of cyanide, and he's not going to put his pack on.
Right.
Well, on the other hand, it's just as obvious to me that a firefighter, if he's going to be asked to guess whether or not there's cyanide or whether or not there's high CO levels, he's going to guess in favor of staying in there and getting the job done.
Yeah. And you really did hit the nail on the head, cultural. And it's easy for people listening or people who are thinking about this. And then please don't take it as criticism when I said that, because you know, only in the last couple of years have I become religious about wearing my mask for many times.
Billy, we had a 4-alarm fire 2 weeks ago, and I was at a command post about a half a block away from the fire.
Right.
And I'm pretty religious too, but I don't wear an air pack in my command post.
Of course not.
The wind shifted, but I did have a CO meter in my command post, okay?
Uh-huh.
The wind shifted, and I had 300 parts per million of carbon monoxide at my command post a half a block away from the fire.
And see, just what you said there, we would go screaming to a carbon monoxide run where people have 15 or 20 parts per million and tell them to get out of the house and everything. But here we are standing in the middle of it. And
if I didn't have the CO meter, I would have just held my breath until the wind left. And
just
then,
another blow. You know. Exactly.
But I think, again, the key to this, we've got sharp firefighters out there, and we've got firefighters with good motives. And I think that if we can get the instrumentation, we need the instrumentation, give the firefighters the instrumentation, let them make informed decisions about what they're confronting. Don't make them guess. I mean, we stopped guessing. When I came into the fire service, we used to guess about natural gas leaks.
Sure, right,
okay?
Right.
Well, we don't guess anymore. We go in there with meters and we know, okay? And we need to do the same thing with CO, cyanide, and any of the other toxic gases that are in fire.
A good rule of thumb that I've been preaching to our firefighters and when we do some classes is even if you're not sure what you see, mask up. I mean, if you got smoke showing, and why would you take that chance? And again, I understand that we want to try and, you know, in case we get ourselves in trouble, you need to try and save what air you have.
Right.
But I think when you hit the nail on the head, Kurt, when you talk about a cultural issue, it truly is. And we are in the middle of a positive cultural change in this business. I know in the years you've been on the job,
absolutely,
we're seeing firefighters operating totally differently, a lot more focused. I don't think we've ever seen a time where we're more focused on firefighters you know, getting out alive and returning home after every run. And this is just one more example of, you know, when in doubt, mask up. If you can see the stuff, put your mask on.
Right.
And along with instrumentation, I like what you're bringing up here. Why wouldn't we have something attached to our air?
Why ask people to guess?
Right.
When we don't have to guess, we have instrumentation.
Yeah. Well, between that and common sense, the mixture of the two would jolt the firefighter into remembering, hey, there's cyanide here. Mask up. There's no question.
Right. Well, I'm sure the first guy who decided to put brake lights in cars,
right?
people probably said, if you need brake lights, you shouldn't be driving cars.
That's right.
But
bam.
The reality is, we need to keep moving forward in this, and I think instrumentation is one of the keys.
Just a couple quick things. What are we going to see in the report when our listeners click and open up that PDF? Just in a quick overview.
Well, we gave a pretty comprehensive background of cyanide. We looked at why this hasn't been solved before, why no one's noticed this before, and I think it goes to the issue I talked about before, the blood tests. We talked about the three fires. We talk about some of the factual issues at the fires and you know, who was where and how we're not real sure about whether or not the cyanide is localized in a certain area or whether the cyanide is throughout the smoke or whether the cyanide is even outside the smoke. And those are some of the unanswered. We get into a discussion about some of the things that cyanide can cause, which one of the biggest concerns is heart attacks.
Right, and you had that. You actually experienced that.
Well, we did, and again, you know, we had the first fire was at 10 o'clock on March 23rd, and one of our firefighters went down. He was sort of incoherent and, you know, typical smoke inhalation, honestly. But the doc ordered the cyanide, and they, you know, fortunately they did the test and found out that he was high in cyanide. A bunch of other guys went, and subsequently when the firefighter had the heart attack the next morning at 2 o'clock in the morning.
That's firefighter Baker?
That's Ken Baker.
Okay, now how's he doing?
Well, you know, he's progressing. He's got some memory issues. You know, he was without air for a little bit, and you know how much of that was related to the cyanide, how much of it was related to, you know, just having to go through the process of CPR and you know, being defibrillated and so on. But you know,
and he was the pump operator. Is that correct?
Yeah, but we concluded that his exposure happened at the second fire. He was on the line at the second fire.
Okay.
So the second fire was at 6 o'clock at night on the 23rd.
Yeah.
And so he was exposed at that fire, and then he happened to have a heart attack at the third fire, but he wasn't exposed to smoke at the third fire.
Okay. Kurt, any final thoughts for our listeners?
Read the report. There's an awful lot there. And anybody who thinks that there's going to be a simple solution to this, even myself, I mean, I may talk about instrumentation. That's only part of it. That's only part of the solution. But anybody who thinks there's a simple solution to this, that you're going to just come out with an order and tell everybody to wear their masks and that's going to be the end of it, is living in a dream world. It's a complex problem, but it is something that we're going to be able to solve now that we know that it's out there.
Well, you know, honestly, the more forget about orders and policies. Of course, we need those. But the more firefighters themselves, the ones that are on the line doing the job, that read this report, we might actually be able to solve the problem from the inside out for them understanding it, their understanding the importance of recognizing what they're going to see, them pushing for instrumentation, and them pushing each other to make sure they're fully PPE'd up before they approach a scene. So,
and Billy, there is one more thing: the whole heart attack issue.
Uh-huh.
Ken Baker had a heart attack at a fire scene, and we can't say for sure it was cyanide related. All we can say is that he had high levels of cyanide in his blood at the time he had the heart attack. So we can't say the cyanide caused this heart attack, but we can say that he had cyanide in his blood. But the bottom line is Ken Baker went down at a fire, had a heart attack, and was resuscitated by fire department paramedics at the scene. We have to look at it. For a long time, we've cited the statistic, 100 firefighters a year are killed in line of duty, approximately half are heart attack related.
Medical related, sure.
Well, I think the question becomes not how many firefighters have heart attacks and die at fires, but how many firefighters are having heart attacks. And we don't really have a good handle on that. The NFPA estimates it's between 200 and 300 a year. But that 200 to 300 aren't fatalities, because of the fact that we have paramedics and advanced life support units standing by at the scene.
Sure.
And I wonder if the fire service is really ready for the reality that could very easily be, if we didn't have these ALS units standing by, if we were commercial fishermen out at sea or timber loggers in the woods or miners in a mine, easily have 200 to 300 fatalities at fires.
Right. Well, and it also emphasizes the point of the need to have EMS on the scene of any working incident. Now, believe me, there's still a lot of areas that don't have that, call for them when we need them.
You know, that's part of the problem. Also, some of the research that we found is that heart arrhythmias can be created up to 2 weeks after a cyanide exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So that the fact that a firefighter goes to a fire and then a couple of days later has a heart arrhythmia is really a concern. You can't just dismiss it and say, it was congenital,
right,
or it was meant to be, or he had a heart condition, that it could still be related to the smoke.
Well, you know what else is going on right now, Kurt, and you bring up a great point, is as much as we're really focused on firefighter line-of-duty deaths now, and again, like I said before, we've never had a time where we've been so focused, what's starting to emerge from that is, but what about the injuries?
Yeah,
what about the heart attacks that didn't die, things like that?
Right.
And I think in the next year or so, we're going to start seeing, and I certainly would support, a national reporting system that ties in all the medical-related situations that you, thank God, didn't die on, but yet we need to track that too.
Right. Well, I think if you look in our report, you're going to see that we've had a couple of medical conditions within our department identified there. We had four guys all go blind in their left eye. Four firefighters on the same shift all go blind in the left eye within about a two-month period.
Incredible.
And we had them tested by neuro-ophthalmologists, and they concluded, this was back in 1990, that there was no connection. Now we do the cyanide research, and lo and behold, cyanide can cause all four of the conditions that the four members had.
You're starting to see that.
So, and the same thing, we've got, we did a quick run of about a year and a half on cardiac arrhythmias, and we've had 13 members with cardiac arrhythmias, over half of them AFib, related to what we feel is related to possible cyanide exposures at fires, possible smoke inhalation. So that, you know, we know the cyanide can cause arrhythmias, and we've got a high number of firefighters showing up with arrhythmias that they're there and then they go to the cardiologist, they take a couple of weeks off from work, all of a sudden they're fine again.
Right back on the saddle again, sure.
Yeah, no congenital issue, no long-term chronic problem. So what was causing that?
Has a lot to look into here. Well, listen, we're talking with Deputy Assistant Fire Chief Kurt Varone, who was chairman of the task force that looked into the entire hydrogen cyanide issue that was raised here in Providence recently. Our deepest thanks to Fire Chief David Costa for his cooperation in sharing this information with the fire service, and IAFF Local 799, Paul Dowdy, also for his great cooperation. And on behalf of all of us, Kurt, please reach out to Paul, let him know that we're glad he's doing okay. We heard earlier this morning he was caught up in a mayday, but luckily the Providence firefighters got in, got him and another firefighter out, and they're doing well. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I think Paul's mission in life is to give me a heart attack.
Well,
and,
yeah,
that's I was the incident commander, and so I kind of feel you know he was. He did that on my account, but now Paul's fine. We had the rapid intervention crew and also a couple of other companies get up there and get him out, so he's fine.
Outstanding. Well, our best wishes to Paul, to Chief Costa, and all the other firefighters that were involved in this situation as well related to cyanide. And lastly, a fire that started with a lightning bolt destroyed a church in Claremont, Minnesota this week, and a firefighter who battled the blaze was seriously injured. Around 2 a.m. on Tuesday, fire crews from several towns responded to St. John's Lutheran Church. It was basically fully engulfed within an hour. Claremont firefighter Gail Spinecta, while trying to save some stained glass windows, was injured after a wall on the south side of the church collapsed on him. He was transported by helicopter to St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, where he remains in critical condition at the time of this broadcast. So we're wishing Gail, the firefighter out in Claremont, the best for a quick recovery, and also the firefighters involved in Claremont. And again, let's all keep in mind, and look, there's nothing more sacred than a church fire, a synagogue, or a temple, or whatever you have, any kind of house of worship. We sometimes want to go the extra mile to protect such important things that are important to people in the community. But we got to think about the risk versus benefit. Risk versus benefit. Well, that ties into firefighter safety. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Rich Duffy, Bill Killen, and Gary Breeze about the 2006 Stand Down for Firefighter Safety. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
You know, you've heard about Where's Waldo, or maybe you've seen that show, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Well, my question is, where in the world is Harry Carter? Harry Carter, you know Harry from Firehouse.com and a number of other venues. Well, Harry is going to be taking his 2006 Fire Act road trip. I don't know if you've heard about this or not, but Harry's going to travel the country visiting fire departments to find out where the true value is with Fire Act grants. In other words, we know lots of departments have gotten funding. Well, Harry's going to go out there and provide the necessary information to prove that the Fire Act grant is a good thing and the funding needs to not only be continued, but needs to be increased. I had a chance to chat with Harry just a little while ago prior to this show, so we're going to plug that in real quick. It's just a couple minutes, but listen in as Harry explains to me what his plans are for the 2006 Fire Act road trip. Take a listen, and right after that, we'll come back with the information regarding the firefighter stand down. Hey, you're listening to Through the Smoke. This is Billy Goldfeder on radio at firehouse.com. You know, an old friend of mine, and I don't mean old in age, but an old friend of mine, and probably yours, is Harry Carter. Harry's retired chief of retired battalion chief, because that would start riots if I said retired chief of Newark, New Jersey. Now I'll just say it anyway. Harry's also still a very active volunteer firefighter, a former volunteer fire chief. And Harry, are you still a fire commissioner as well?
As a matter of fact, Billy, I'm chairman of the board of District 2 in Howe Township.
Well, welcome to the show, Harry.
Thank you very much, Bill.
We're talking with Harry about, well, I mean, we could probably spend a day just talking with Harry about all kinds of cool stuff, but specifically, if you've been following some of the news, Harry is going to be traveling across parts of the country to talk with firefighters about Fire Act grants to see where they have paid off, where maybe they haven't paid off. Harry, what's the basis for this? Where did this idea come from for you to take the Harry Carter road trip?
Well, for years I've been thinking about going out there and meeting the people that are really doing the job, but I've been tied up in school the last 3 years. And at FDIC, I was sitting with a bunch of my buddies from Massachusetts, and we were talking about my road trip. And Jack Peltier from the Mass Firefighting Academy says to me, "Have you ever thought about making it a trip to study the Fire Act?" I said, "Geez, Jack, nobody's done that." And that was the genesis of the idea back in Indianapolis in April, and since then it has started to come together quite well.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comment, Harry, because there's, from my standpoint, there's a couple different ways of looking at the Fire Act grants. I mean, clearly, some fire departments that would not have had now do have, thanks to the Fire Act grant. And unfortunately, in almost all cases, the reason some fire departments don't have is because their local communities don't support them, whether it be the elected officials, the city managers, the taxpayers, or whatever. And as I've said for years, you know, you get what you pay for, and if those people are not willing to, you know, put up some funding, then that's the level of service you get. But here comes the white horse of the federal government delivering basically your local tax dollars back to you. That's really what it comes to. And allowing fire departments to provide that extra service in spite of some communities that won't allow their fire departments to provide what's needed. So, I mean, from that standpoint, I've been a big fan of the Fire Act grants. On the other side of the coin, some of it makes me crazy. I'm familiar, for example, of one town in Pennsylvania. They cover one square mile, and they've got approval to hire, and this, of course, is the SAFER grants, they've gotten approval to hire two career firefighters to cover one square mile. Makes no sense to me. There ought to be a law that says, yeah, we're going to give you money to staff your volunteer department during the day, but you also must respond and assist, you know, five or six other neighboring departments, things like that. So that's one issue that maybe we'll talk about some other time. But the other thing is that there are communities that have gotten Fire Act grant money that have no business getting that kind of money compared to the departments that are out there suffering, still using antiquated air packs, antiquated gear, and things like that, because maybe they don't know how to write a grant. So what's the purpose of you traveling around, visiting and talking with the departments, Harry? Is it to see if these grants really have made a difference, or what?
Well, the actual idea is that many of us at the national level have been saying it's an important program, it's a great program, and I have heard people, you know, state the problems you mentioned, but nobody has actually gone out and quantified the impact. So it is my hope to meet with the people out there in the street, the kind of folks that do the job every day, just like our folks here in Adelphia do, and to see how the grant impacted them. I'm actually starting my road trip 6.1 miles from where I'm sitting right now in Farmingdale, New Jersey, a mutual aid partner that always had trouble raising money. The borough there is somewhere between penurious and really cheap, and we would always be giving them our cast-off gear, our old pagers, and our leftover hose. Well, since the two back-to-back Fire Act grants, they saved enough money to allow the borough to take the money they might have spent to buy them a second new commercial pumper. This is a significant item.
So this is really an opportunity for someone, meaning you, to go out and really determine, did the Fire Act grant funding matter?
Well, there's another place in Star City, West Virginia, where a good friend of mine from NIOSH hangs out, and he has spoken about the seed change in the course of the fire company based upon the new money, the new clothing, the new SCBA, the whole thing. It's changed the morale. People are coming back around. Well, I want to capture those sorts of real-life things and show the world that this isn't just some giant federal giveaway like those boobs in the Washington Times tried to portray a couple weeks ago,
right,
where they were talking about puppet shows and gyms. Well, you know, Bill, and I know, that those are not puppet shows. Those are efforts by our dedicated fire prevention people
to save the
lives of the future, the pub ed right. folks, to save lives in the future. And since you and I both know that people are dropping over dead from heart attacks, the fitness equipment is essential. So
yeah.
I want to create a series of daily blog commentaries to show where I've been and what I've found, and then I'm going to put it together into, I don't want to say book, pamphlet, maybe a monograph. And then Dennis Compton has asked me to deliver a paper in Washington next January on my findings. Well, I'll be delivering at the conference where the papers funded by the Fire Act will be delivered. So I think we can do something here, but the key is meeting real people and having the real people that I meet make sure that their local TV and radio stations that are now One great contact I made was a gentleman up in Escambia County, Pennsylvania, up by Johnstown. That's
right.
Cambria County, excuse me.
Cambria, right.
Yeah, and turns out he's best buddies with the chief of staff to Congressman Murtha. Well, now those are the kind of people
that
I
matters.
Need.
Yeah, that absolutely matters. And don't get me wrong, I'm not, I mean, I'm a big fan of the Fire Act Grant program, and not only has my department benefited to some extent from that, but many departments who had nothing do now have assistance, and that's a big deal. And and I think your point, and I was talking to Gary Breeze a few weeks ago, and he made almost the same comment. We've gotten all this money. Has it mattered? And I think you're going to be answering that question when you start this trip. What areas do you plan on visiting this summer, Harry?
Well, so far, starting in Farmingdale, New Jersey, and moving westward, I'm going to be doing stops in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota. I'm going to duck down into Iowa, and then double back through Tennessee, Alabama, and it's either going to be Virginia, West Virginia, or the reverse of that. Then I'm going to bounce up through Maryland and interview the chief of the Wilmington Fire Department in Delaware, who has benefited from four successive years of Fire Act money, and he is a strong proponent.
Let me just interrupt you a minute. You said something that really stuck in my thoughts a few seconds ago, and that's something I never gave much thought to. You mentioned about the volunteer fire department, and this could apply to a career fire department as well, where maybe the firefighters are highly spirited, gung-ho, enthusiastic, but due to lack of a local support or lack of available funding, morale has plummeted. And that's not obviously not only the reason for morale problems, but what you just mentioned is here's a small volunteer company where they got just enough help where it turned their morale around and it renewed spirit to the organization. There's a lot to be said for that.
Well, precisely, when
you have better
precisely.
Volunteer department, when morale is up and spirit's up, your response turnout is up. It's a proven fact.
Yep, and that's what I want to do. I want to meet the real people. The basis for my road trip goes back to the years before World War II when one of my heroes, Ernie Pyle, the late war correspondent, made his way across America, traveling all 48 states and Alaska with his wife in a Ford. I mean, they went every place. I've reviewed his monographs on this, and it's his style that I've adopted. You go out and you meet the real America, not the 10,000 people that you and I meet at the conferences, Billy,
right,
but the people that are out there every day in the
right
trenches, shoveling the mud.
You know who else did that? Our late friend Jim Page did that, not on the fire at Grand Pump, but his point was to visit and talk to real firefighters as opposed to those representing them or claiming to represent them, and I think Jim would be proud of what you're doing too.
Well, Jim and I talked about this.
Is that right? Did he?
We were going to, at some point in the next few years, I would start from the East Coast, he would start from the West, and like the two railroads meeting at Promontory Point, we'd shake hands somewhere in the middle of the country.
Well, he was driving a 1950s vintage rescue truck, his old Rescue 8 truck.
That's
what
correct.
Are you going to be driving? Do you have plans for any vehicle?
Well,
I know the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile is tied up this summer.
Well, I've been trying to meet with one of the manufacturers of command vehicles, but I can't crack through to the upper level where the guy will say, gee, that sounds good. Every time that there's a picture taken for Harry's program, they'll see our vehicle with our name on it. I keep getting secretaries and lower-level salespeople with no imagination.
Well, hopefully somebody's listening. I'll tell you what, if I owned a vehicle company, or if I owned a business that sold products such as, you know, command vehicles, I think it would be a great opportunity just to loan you. You're not asking to keep it.
Ooh.
Just to loan you a suburban type vehicle or a, you know, Tahoe or whatever it might be with their logo all over it.
I wouldn't mind that. Just given the size of me as a person, we're not going out there in a Yugo.
No, I wouldn't recommend that. Otherwise, you can have somebody follow you with a Herstal.
But you know, Billy, there are those who do recognize the value of my trip. I've already been given a grant by the fire apparatus manufacturers,
excellent,
and another grant by the Fire Equipment Manufacturers Association.
Well, Harry, on this on the bottom of this broadcast page, I'm going to have a link on there, and if they click that link, they'll be able to write to you if anyone listening would like to contribute to your trip, again, to seek out information on the facts and the successes of the Fire Act grant program, So if any of the manufacturers or dealers out there are listening, just click the link we have right here on the page.
Yeah, I want to also assure you, Billy, that this ain't a moneymaker for Harry Carter.
No, understood.
I already told Ron Sarnicki that should any money be left over after this, it's going to go to the National Fallen Firefighters. I just love the work you guys do. And you notice Steve Austin and I are pitching in doing our level best with ResponderSafety.com. So this isn't a moneymaker. This is, it's almost like a crusade. I feel like Don Quixote with a bedpan on my head going out to find a windmill. But that's
Harry,
what I want to do.
When do you plan on taking off?
Well, it looks like July 6 or 7.
Okay.
Because I have to swing it west and then swing it east to be in Baltimore for Firehouse. Then I'm going to double back through West Virginia and end up in Greencastle for the Cumberland Valley Volunteer Firemen's Conference the first week of August. So,
very nice.
If nobody offers a command vehicle, then my dear Suburban with 100,000 miles on it will get about 4,000 more. I'm going to do this, Billy. I'd like help, but gall darn it, I'm going to do this.
And if those who are listening who want to track your progress, how are they going to be able to do that, Harry?
Well, right now, Chris Hebert and Eric Smith are setting up a blog, and they're attempting to build a sponsorship for my daily blog. And personally, I'm going to try and cut a deal with Hampton Inns. I love Hampton Inns. They've got Wi-Fi and high speed in every location. Ergo, I'll be able to set up camp in each place I go.
Right. So you're going to maintain a blog through firehouse.com.
That's correct.
In some manner. Okay. Very good. Any final words on your trip, Harry? I'll tell you, it sounds great. I would love to join you on something like that. I think it would be a lot of fun, and as I mentioned to a lot of people that I get to meet as I travel across the United States and Canada, there's nothing better than sitting around just chatting with some firefighters and BSing. You're going to be doing the same thing, only with a much stronger focus, and that is, look, we got these millions of dollars from the federal government. Let's show the federal government and those who are naysayers that maybe aren't supporting the Fire Act grant program, hey, look, it works, and here's a local level snapshot, so to speak, through your trip of how it's working. Is that a fair assessment?
Bill, that's my intention in its entirety. I want to go out. I want to see. I want to tell. I will be the journalist visiting and asking who, what, when, where, how, and why questions in order to come to a good understanding of the value of the program. You and I have talked at length on this. We've heard our friends at the big conventions. It's great. It's great. But I'm going to go out and talk to the people.
Yeah, show me the money.
Show me the money.
Show me what you did with it. Yeah. Harry, let's say there's someone listening now who says, well, I live in West Virginia or I live in Ohio, and I'd like Harry to come by our department and see what we've done with the Fire Act grant funds. How can they do that?
Well, just click onto that link you're going to put.
Okay, and they can write you the same way.
Yeah, and it may be that this isn't the 2006, this is the first annual.
Right. Right,
so, because there's only so many places I can go in 30 days, and the charming Mrs. Carter has given me a 30-day permission slip.
The charming Mrs. Carter, who we can also send donations to for a whole other reason.
Well, were we of the Catholic faith, our sainthood would already have been assured.
Well, listen, you're listening to RadioFirehouse.com. We've been chatting with former chief and current fire commissioner and active volunteer firefighter Harry Carter, well-known through his column in Firehouse Magazine and Firehouse.com. Harry, we wish you the best, and hopefully we've been able to generate even more support for this great trip you're going on.
Bill, I thank you very much for what you've done.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
Hey, we're back. This is Billy Goldfeder, your host at Firehouse Through the Smoke at the radio at firehouse.com. The second International Firefighter Safety Stand Down starting on June 21st. And again, Wednesday, June 21st, and it's going to continue for several days until you are able to make sure that all of your firefighters, all your shifts, all your volunteers, whatever you have, are covered and have a heightened awareness on what they need to be focused on during that activity. Now, below on the website here, click several links and you'll be able to get a lot of great information, so make sure you take care of that. Pretty much it's done for you. You just got to download this stuff and apply it to your organization. Now, the IFC and the IFF are the key leaders with this, and of course, with the IFC, the IFC Safety, Health, and Survival Section play an extremely active role in this, but also NIOSH, ISFSI, National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, United States Fire Administration, National Volunteer Fire Council, and just about every North American, meaning United States and Canadian, firefighter associations are involved in this. And that's a big deal. It says that more and more we're starting to get it in relation to the issues of firefighter safety and survival. So let's just take a look. Now, what are the events that we're planning? Well, first of all, prior to June 21st, you need to be listening to shows like this. Have your firefighters gather around, hit play, and listen to what we have to talk about today so they can get into the spirit of things and understand what's going on. Now, June 21st, and basically continue this until everybody's covered, you're going to maybe consider a department-wide radio announcement, a moment of silence for line-of-duty deaths, review of shift activities, and explain to all your troops the purpose, or if you're a volunteer department, what you're going to do that evening. Review the line-of-duty death causes. Take a look at some of the NIOSH reports and recommendations. And again, below, look at all the links we've provided to you. Just start clicking away. This year, the entire focus of your firefighters needs to be, specifically for the stand-down, vehicle safety and what can be done to improve fire and emergency service vehicle safety department-wide and individually. So that's what you want to really, that's really the focus of the stand-down. How not to get ourselves hurt or killed while responding, while operating, and while returning in relation to our vehicles. So that's pretty much what we're going to be talking about. There's other activities as well, and I don't want to spend too much time on there of your time right now as far as, you know, discussing what we're doing. Is I'd rather get to the interviews of who we have. But really, again, I want you to understand the focus is vehicular safety. Now, my guests this week are Chief Bill Killen, Mr. Rich Duffy, and Mr. Gary Breeze. A little bit about them. Bill Killen, who's been on the show before, is an old friend, currently the president of the IAFC, is a retired fire chief. Bill has served as fire chief of the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, which is Reagan and National. He was head of the United States Naval Fire Service. 49 years on the job, includes working at the University of Maryland. He was a fire chief in Florida. Many of you may not know, but if you ever see Bill, look on his lapel. He's got a real neat pin he wears. He was part of the Kennedy Space Center Fire Department astronaut rescue team. Ask him about that. He's got a lot to share with you. So it's a pleasure, again, to have Bill with us. Rich Duffy, a good friend, and I'll tell you, I don't know many folks who are more focused on firefighter safety and survival than Rich Duffy, operating under General President Harold Schaeberger. Again, Rich's entire mission, his whole being, is making sure firefighters return home safely after all runs. And Rich has been involved with worker occupational health and safety issues for over 30 years, with the past 28 of them at the IFF, where he is currently the assistant to the General President, responsible for the IFF's activities addressing occupational medicine, safety, and health. Rich is responsible for the development and implementation of all occupational safety and health activities for the IFF, including the IFF's Department of Occupational Health and Safety, their medical residency program, which is in cooperation with Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and Hygiene, the John P. Redmond Foundation, the IFF's Committees on Health, Safety, and Employee Assistance Programs, the IFF PSOB program, and the IFF IAFC Wellness Fitness Initiative. Rich has provided technical assistance on firefighter health and safety issues and is internationally recognized as a firefighter's health and safety expert. He's authored numerous books, manuals, and articles on firefighter occupational health and safety issues. It's a real pleasure to have Rich on board representing the International Association of Firefighters. And Gary Breeze, another returning friend to Through the Smoke, who's been on the radio show with us before. Gary's been is the IAFC's executive director, of course, and he's been that since 1985. He deserves a medal for that. Been the executive director of the IFC since 1985. Gary's got more than 30 years' experience in the fire service, and has served as a volunteer chief officer, a career firefighter, and publicly elected chairman of the Board of Fire Commissioners for a fire district. So Gary's had his hands in this for a long, long time. Professionally, he holds numerous certifications and today continues as an active member of the fire service, providing guidance through his role as the executive director of the IFC. So again, it's a pleasure to have them back. We're going to kick off these discussions in just 1 minute. We'll be right back.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
Well, we're back on radio at Firehouse.com Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. It's the second International Firefighter Safety Stand Down, starting on June 21st, and we're talking with IFC President Bill Killen, IFC Executive Director Gary Breeze, and the IAFF Director of Health and Safety, Rich Duffy, and we appreciate everybody being here. Gary, let's start with you. How about from the staff standpoint, and then I'm going to pass it on to Chief Killen. From the staff standpoint, what have you been doing to prepare for the stand down, and why another stand down?
Well, first, let me answer the second question first. Why another stand down is because the fire service needs to have a particular time that they focus on firefighter safety. Yes, we're supposed to do this throughout the year, you know, 24/7, 365. But the reality is, when we focus on it, it draws people's attention to it. And this year, we've got two key areas: seatbelt usage and intersections. And what the staff's been doing is bringing resources together and posting them on the website so that those can be passed off to everybody else. And Billy, you've been a big help to us in that, in getting SOGs, SOPs in from various states around the nation to post up there so states can use them, departments can use them as examples.
Excellent, excellent. Well, the reason I guess we focused on the specific state ones, because when we're talking about traffic safety and response issues, each state is a little bit different as far as what their laws are and stuff. So I guess that's kind of what our motivation was. And plus, we're really going to be creating a nice large library that we can build on that other fire departments can pull through. And I'll tell you, working with your staff, Sean and the rest of the bunch up there, they've done a great job focused on this. Chief Killen, Bill Killen, boy, you've gotten a lot done in your presidency and with the National Fire Mutual Aid Program and now the second stand down. How about some thoughts from you as you've traveled the country as our president?
Well, Billy, it's really been a ride, and I'm grateful to have such a great team behind me with the IFC staff, our board of directors, our divisions, our sections and committees. It really makes it easy to get something accomplished. It's very important that we continue this second national stand down because we're still having the firefighter deaths and injuries across the country, and we're seeing those things in accidents, at intersections, and lack of seatbelt usage. In fact, I just got an email about a lawsuit filed against a manufacturer and others where a firefighter was killed that was not belted in. And Tennessee passed a law last year requiring all emergency vehicle operators to have a minimum of 2 hours annual training in driving and operating emergency vehicles. So Tennessee recognized, as many other organizations and states have recognized, that emergency vehicles in responding to emergencies through intersections is a major problem, as well as the use of seatbelts. And I'm very grateful that we've got such a great team here at IFC working on making this second annual stand down a very positive and productive event.
You know, there's never been a time, at least in my 30-something years, that we've been so focused on firefighter safety and survival, and that's great. Honestly, just talking about it is an improvement compared to years ago. We just wouldn't talk about it. Rich, as far as the IFF, I know you guys are majorly on board and a major partner with the IFC on this. You guys have a long history at the IFF of taking care of your members, your firefighters, whether it be the Joint Labor Management Wellness Fitness Task Force, the CPAT program, the Peer Fitness Trainer Certification. I mean, what else has the IFF got going on for their membership? And in particular, what are you suggesting your membership do related to this year's stand down?
Well, first of all, let me say that we're once again glad to cooperate in the stand down day or the stand down days this year with the International Association of Fire Chiefs. During the past almost 15 years now, we've worked cooperatively on a number of programs directly related to firefighters' health and safety, where I certainly believe we've not only were able to put down joint documents out to the field, but certainly that cooperative effort alone has made the job and the occupation of firefighting that much safer. I believe this year's event certainly reflects the unfortunate, the continued unfortunate experience of firefighters getting killed, seriously injured, or injured at all while responding to returning from or operating to an incident or operating on a highway. Again, I believe and I echo the response of my general president, Harold Schaeberger, saying that this is clearly unacceptable. 25% of the deaths last year alone were related to those particular activities in the fire service. And I certainly believe in the 28 years I've been working with the International Association of Firefighters, this has been unfortunately growing and very fortunately preventable. None of those deaths should occur last year or in the preceding years while responding to an emergency incident, coming back from the incident, or certainly operating on roadways. We, as well as the fire chiefs and the volunteers as well, worked cooperatively during the past year with the United States Fire Administration. We've all developed specific programs on emergency vehicle safety that have been that are all web-based, and in fact, because of the demand, the continued demand since we've gone on live on our website for the product that we produced, we are now producing over 4,000 DVDs of that same product, which are going in the mail this week in time for our membership to utilize during the stand-down days in 2 weeks.
That's an outstanding program. I had a chance to preview it a couple months ago, and it really matters. And the resources such as that, as well as more generic resources, are available for those of you listening. Just click to the links at the bottom of the page from the radio show when you clicked on, and there's loads of information. There's no excuse for you not to participate in the standout coming up. I'll tell you also, and this is related and unrelated depending upon how you look at it, but yeah, there's never been a time where we're more focused on firefighter safety and survival, but there's also never been a time where the firefighters and the chiefs, the IFF, the IFC, and other organizations are focused jointly together. And I'll tell you, for someone who's been around from when I started in the 70s to now, it's inspiring to see that this many organizations are working together. I want to touch on one issue. Let's talk about seatbelts. On one hand, it's very easy for us to say, put your seatbelt on. Don't move the truck without a seatbelt on. On the other hand, it's extremely difficult for a firefighter to wear their gear, to put on their pack, to put on their radios, etc., and fit into some of the cabs that are being designed for firefighters to respond in. Now, there's a couple schools of thought. One is, screw it. Don't put your shit on until you get to the scene. Get in the apparatus, put your belt on, quit your whining, and you'll pack up and gear up when you get there. And that's fine, unless you pull up and then you have one of those rare occasions where you've got to get into that house and grab that family or grab that baby. And as much as I do strongly feel, the answer is, if you can't securely put your belt on with your equipment on, don't put your equipment on until you get to the scene. But what about a change? Are you guys aware of anything going on the street? Because I've been pushing manufacturers pretty hard to come up with a system where firefighters can belt up while still putting on all their equipment. Let me run to Rich with this one. Rich, are you aware of anything out there that's being worked on so we can sort of do both and arrive to be more effectively?
Well, first let me. I have to say from the beginning, if you don't get there, you're not going to be able to rescue anybody. So I think the case is very clear. You put your seatbelt on. and not use that traveling time for adjusting, climbing around a cab and putting on equipment. There's plenty of time to do that once you get to the emergency scene. So I think that that is a false excuse. We live in a society there's very few people that don't wear seatbelts, and we've made excuses over the years for why the fire service shouldn't be required to do that. And I think the number of fatalities and the injuries with vehicle accidents have demonstrated that seatbelt use is lax, and that's that we find that to be highly unacceptable. With all the rules and regulations in the fire service, you think one that was as demonstrably so important be enforced. So I don't think this is a technology issue. This is a regulation issue and an issue that should be enforced through the company officer and the command of the fire department.
Absolutely, and I hope you didn't feel like I set you up, but that's exactly the answer I was hoping to hear, and that's what we need to be preaching. Yeah, it's great for us to be prepared when we get there, but we got to get there. And if you get ejected, you know, or hurt on the way, or worse, even killed, it isn't going to make any difference. Bill Killen, some comments. I know you're living now in rural Tennessee, and you've got a lot of experience in dealing with some of the, you know, less funded fire departments, and what about them? They don't have four-man cabs, and some of them still riding tailboard, and how do you help solve those problems?
Well, that's a tough one, but fortunately, in the area where I am in East Tennessee, they've got a policy, nobody rides the tailboards.
I meant four-door cab, but yeah, right,
but,
okay.
But when you look at the four-door cabs, and one of the confusions, and I really agree with what Rich said, belt up. And you stop and think about a lot of these cabs that are where it's really open, and so the driver hears all the confusion. He hears the radio. The officer's trying to put together some information, and the troops need to be seated and belted and quiet so that the driver can concentrate on getting the rig there, the officer can get the facts together, and I really think that that's a critical issue. One of the concerns I have is that a lot of rural fire departments, particularly in East Tennessee, some of the rigs are homemade, like tankers, and some of them have seat belts, and some of them. But the real problem is usage of the seat belt. We need to do a real solid job of training our people. Seat belts, seat belts, seat belts.
And it takes the firefighter being self-disciplined and the officer saying, "Look, we're not going to leave until you got your belt on." Gary, isn't this really shut up, belt up?
Well, it's that. It is that, Billy. But I think I think that's about as clear as it's got to be. I mean, it has been reflected in both Rich and Chief Killen's comments, and it starts with the company officer. It starts with the firefighter.
Yep.
You know, now one of the things that the discussion hasn't talked about is POVs. We have a tremendous amount of incidents that happen every year with POVs going back and forth.
Personally owned vehicles responding to calls.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yep.
Going back and forth to calls or responding to the station so they can get on the truck or responding to the scene. And all of that's got to be put into this. It's not just while you're on the truck. It's while you're responding. It's while you're returning. All of that stuff. It's driver safety, seatbelt awareness, intersection safety.
Let's talk about intersection safety when we come right back. We're talking with Chief Bill Killen, Director Rich Duffy, Assistant to the General President in charge of Occupational Medicine, Health and Safety at the IFF, and of course, President Bill Killen of the IFC. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
We're back on Through the Smoke at RadioFirehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder. We're talking to Gary Breeze, Bill Killen, and Rich Duffy. Gary and Bill from the IAFC, and Rich, of course, from the IAFF. Intersections, red lights, and stop signs. We've seen some hellacious apparatus incidents, as well as vehicular, staff vehicles and personally owned vehicle responses. But intersections, red lights, and stop signs. Yesterday, I'm not in my own jurisdiction. I see a ladder company blow right through a red light. It's still happening. They don't seem to get it. How are we going to make them get it? Let's start with Rich Duffy. Rich, stopping at intersection, red lights, and stop signs.
I mean, I think it's very clear. I mean, second to seatbelt usage. I mean, any traveling to or from an incident, that vehicle needs to come to a stop at all negative right-of-ways, and not proceed until they are assured that that it's safe. And you know, I think you can point back to the incident now a couple years ago in New York City, where there was a civilian killed. When a red light when the apparatus went through the red light.
Right.
I think it's I think the issue there, and there was a there was considerable discussion from the fire department, certainly both for our locals in New York City, the Uniform Firefighters Association, Uniform Fire Officers Association, told their membership that that indeed the only safe way to respond was by stopping at negative right of way intersections, including yield signs, stop signs, and red lights. They did so. I think accidents statistics almost, and I think in the first 6 months were reduced by 50 to 60%.
Had a
and,
major impact.
Unfortunately, the other impact was response times went to 6%. Of course, that raised the ire of political officials within.
Right.
And you know what? The answer has been: there's only two ways there's only one way to get to the fire safely, and if you want to increase response times, you don't do it at the risk of not just the firefighters on the rig, but the general public. Blowing stop signs kills people. Very clear, and if they want to increase. If response time needs to be increased in any jurisdiction, address it in terms of resources, put more firehouses in, and don't expect the firefighters and the fire officers to blow through red lights.
To make up for cuts and things like that. Sure, Gary, go ahead.
Yeah, Rich raises an interesting question. You know, I have never seen the number of civilians that are killed or injured by fire apparatus every year.
Yeah.
We know how many firefighters die. But how many citizens do we kill each year or injure each year in traffic accidents? Those are uncounted statistics.
You're right. We just see the newspaper articles every day.
Yep, yeah. That's exactly
right. You're right.
And that might be worth jointly between the IFF and the IFC taking that on at some point.
I think it's certainly worth figuring out a number, because it's not just our personnel. It's the citizens we're sworn to protect.
To do that research. Yeah, you know, there is a... I don't know, those of us who are still and have actively gone to fires over the years know there's that, I guess, stupid mentality of beating the other company in, and we see it in volunteers, we see it in career, it doesn't have any one particular area of ownership, and I'll tell you, it's great to beat the other company in, it's great to get in there, get the line in, get first water on the fire and all that kind of stupid crap, but man, one hit, one clobbering, you kill some mom with her kids in the minivan, and nothing else matters now, and your entire life has changed. And by listening to what Bill and Rich and Gary are saying, so whether you're a volunteer firefighter, you're represented here today. If you're a career firefighter, you're represented here today by your union. Or if you're a fire chief, you're represented here. All aspects have been covered in this quick discussion, because it doesn't need to be a lengthy discussion. Put your damn seatbelts on, quit your whining, start designing apparatus in the future where maybe if you do need to gear up, you can do it safely while belted in and comfortably, and stop at red lights so you don't end up having some tragic event. And you know, the other impact of this is the union and the IAFC and the other organizations will do everything they can to protect your firefighters. But if you break a policy, break a law, run a red light and kill somebody, they may not be able to defend you. It may be indefensible. And then it becomes your own problem, family's problem.
Billy, you're missing another big point on apparatus safety, and that's speed.
Talk about it.
I think, you know, we talked about belting, we talked about intersections, but we also have to look at speed. And those big fire trucks are not designed to do 60 miles an hour around a 35-mile-an-hour
right.
circle. What happens when you do that? They lay on their side, they flip over, and they will happen. Likewise, they're not designed to go 60 miles an hour down a city street, so... I think equally important with seat belting and negative right-of-ways, we do have to address the speed issue. And hey, you know, it sounds like we're taking the last fun part of the job out, but you know
yep.
what? I think the numbers are very clear. We're killing too many people. We're hurting too many people. And that activity is unacceptable, and those deaths and injuries are certainly preventable.
And it's just not worth it. Go ahead, Bill.
And the responsibility is that everybody from the guy that's riding as the officer on that rig all the way up to the fire chief in the department has to take the responsibility to say, we are not going to break the law, we're not going to run the lights, and if you do that, then we need to take disciplinary action, whether it's a career, a paid, volunteer, or on-call. It doesn't make any difference.
Sure.
We do not have the right to take someone else's life through our carelessness. And that's exactly what it's all about.
You, Rich and Gary and Bill, each of you at different times brought this same point up. It's the officer riding in the front seat in many cases that can make or break the safety issues of any fire department. And that is also the most uncomfortable position for so many people. We look forward to getting promoted. You get promoted and, whoa, now I got to supervise my friends, my buddies, my pals. And that's an issue you need to think about before you take the promotion, and an issue for fire chiefs to think about to ensure their people are properly trained in order to supervise their friends, buddies, and pals. Because in small departments, you can't get promoted, you know, two boroughs or three boroughs away. You're stuck working with the people that you have to work with. But you are a lieutenant, you are a captain, whatever rank you are, sergeant, and you did accept the brass, you accepted the responsibility. And that means if you see your personnel doing something unsafe, in particular in today's discussion, your troops are not belting up, your drivers aren't slowing down, and they're not slowing down through intersections and stopping, you are responsible to make sure that happens. A quick final ending with the three busiest people in the fire service, Gary Breeze, Bill Killen, and Rich Duffy. Gary, final thoughts.
It's up to the individual. Bottom line, I think you said it very well, Billy. Buckle up and shut up.
Bill Killen, president of the IAFC. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you on again. Final thoughts, Bill.
I'm just so pleased and proud of the cooperation and the work that we are doing with the International Association of Firefighters to make these stand downs and make our personnel have a better opportunity of everybody going home.
And Rich Duffy, assistant to the general president, Harold Schaeperger of Occupational Medicine, Health and Safety at the IFF. Rich, final thoughts.
This is not just about talking the talk, it's walking the walk. We can do things a lot safer out there. We should be doing a lot safer out there. It's not a question of whether it's the safe way, it's the only way. And I hope people reflect on this during the upcoming stand-down.
Starting Wednesday, June 21st, and continuing all for several days after that, so every firefighter in your department has been covered. Fire departments, career, volunteer, and combination are being urged to suspend all non-emergency activity and focus entirely on firefighter safety and survival. This year's stand-down will highlight on emergency vehicle safety. We're doing it to raise the level of awareness toward firefighter safety and call attention to unacceptable number of line-of-duty deaths and injuries in the fire service. This applies to all fire departments, all ranks, career, volunteer, union, whatever the case may be, because they're all represented today. Our thanks go out to Gary Breeze, Bill Killen, and Rich Duffy. I know how busy you are, and I appreciate you being here with us today.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.